My name is Charles Somm. I direct the policy, education policy initiatives at the Manhattan Institute. Thank you all for joining us this morning. I'll briefly describe the format for the discussion today and introduce our panelists. Marcus Winters, the senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, will get up in a moment and discuss the findings from his most recent paper, Pushed Out, Low-Performing Students at New York City Charter Schools. It's the third in a series of studies Marcus has produced, all supported by the Walton Foundation. Thank you, Walton Foundation. I know a few of you are here. All three studies, the previous two were on English language learners and special education students, debunk some of the myths surrounding charters and also get behind the numbers as to what steps charters might take to do an even better job reaching New York's neediest students. After Marcus presents his findings, we'll have a panel discussion. We're going to save lots of time at the end for Q&A. We have a great audience, so we'll make sure you get to participate. Moderating our panel today will be Josh Greenman. Josh is a member of the editorial board at the New York Daily News, as well as its opinion editor. He's a Twitter virtuoso and an education policy maven in his own right. We also have James Merriman, the indefatigable head of the New York City Charter School Center. James has really helped the Charter Center, and James have really helped the charter sector flourish and grow in New York City, and deserves a lot of credit for that. And James and the Charter Center also hosted events for the release of Marcus's previous two papers, which we had at the Charter Center, and we had really thoughtful, productive discussions on the ELL and special ed issues, and I'm sure we'll have another one today. And next to James is Seth Andrew. Seth is the founder of Democracy Prep Public Schools Charter Network. He now serves as the network superintendent. He's also the chair of Democracy Builders, a nonprofit dedicated to fostering civic participation among charter school parents. Recently, he's been advocating for charters to do more on the backfill issue, which I'm sure we'll hear more about later on today. And last but certainly not least, Ian Rowe, the chief executive officer of Public Prep. It's a nonprofit charter network. Currently, they have three single-sex charter schools across five campuses and one co-ed pre-K program. The pre-K program is really interesting. It's based in a public housing complex in the South Bronx, and it's affiliated with Sesame Street and the Joan Ganz Cooney Foundation, and they're really doing great work. So without further ado, let me turn things over to Marcus Winters.
Okay. Thanks, Charles, and thanks for our great panelists for being here today. I'm going to try to be brief on my side so that we have enough time for conversation with this really great group. I will mention a couple times in my talk, we weren't able to do a PowerPoint today, that there's a couple slides in your thing. You don't have to stare at them all, but I'll refer to a couple figures just briefly in what I'm going to talk about. So empirical research allows for really little doubt at this point that New York City charter schools are effective on average for the students who attend them. There's variation in their quality, but we now have a lot of high-quality research suggesting that on average they're quite effective for students who attend them. We also have some evidence, including some of my own, showing that the increases in the charter sector have had no real negative, certainly not negative impact, and if anything, a slight positive impact on the quality of local public schools. The most common gripe now about the charter sector is that charter school success comes, at least in part, because charters are pushing out their lowest performing and most difficult to educate students. This criticism is now made almost matter-of-factly at times. You see this as just one of many examples. Diane Ravitch has written that charters are free to push out low-scoring students and send them back to their local public schools. The chancellor's relatively recent comments about charter schools, she didn't exactly say this, but it was kind of in the background of what she was talking about, the idea that charters are pushing out their low-performing students. And given the frequency and assuredness that this claim is made, we might suspect that it's backed by more than anecdotal evidence at this point. But that is not the case at this point. To date, we haven't really looked at whether it is the case that low-performing students are more likely to exit charter schools than our other students. I've been engaged in a research agenda in New York City and elsewhere over the last couple of years now, trying to look at the type of student who enters and exits out of the charter school sector. So I'm asking, do charter schools really systematically push out low-performing or otherwise difficult to educate students? And I'm seeing a very consistent story, particularly in New York City, but also elsewhere, that does not seem to be the case, at least not in the enrollment data. So my prior work, which we've discussed at previous panels, looked at the exit enrollment patterns of students with disabilities and those classified as English language learners. In this paper, I'm going head-on on the argument of whether low-performing students themselves are the ones who are exiting charter schools. So I'm looking directly at the exiting behavior of students based on their prior test scores. So are low-performing students more likely to exit New York City charter schools than they are to exit New York City traditional public schools? I use student-level administrative data that contains the test scores and identifiers for each student in school. So I can map. I have their test scores, and I can map them as they move across and out of and into the sector. And I can compare, and what I'm doing is I'm comparing the likelihood that a student exits his school in a given year conditional on last year's test score performance. So I can only do this for students who have standardized test scores and the like, but that's a large group of students. And I'm making these comparisons by their prior test score performance and also by sector. I define low-performing students in the paper in a couple different ways, right? What is a low-performing student? So if we look at it on students scoring below the average within the district in math and ELA, if we look at it as students scoring below the average within their school, is another way that I look at it. And I also look at if you score below the 25th percentile. So different ways are telling us pretty similar stories, it turns out. So what I'm doing here, and in that figure one, I present some basic descriptive results of what's going on here. It is the case that low-performing students are more likely to exit charter schools than are higher-performing students. And that shows up pretty consistently, no matter how we define these things. And that seems consistent, at least with the claim that charters might be pushing out their lowest-performing students. But the problem is we can't end the conversation there. The other thing that we see in the figure, and the important thing to keep in mind, is that this pattern exists equally within the traditional public school sector. So basically what we're seeing is that low-performing students are just more mobile than higher-performing students. They're more likely to exit their school regardless of what sector that they're attending. So this pattern exists equally across those two sectors. So low-performing students are more likely to exit their school regardless of what sector they attend. So if this problem of low-performing students exiting charter schools is a problem, it's equally a problem within the traditional public school system. And these results hold. So those results in that figure are just descriptive without any statistical controls or the like. If we start adding those statistical controls in a regression model, which I talk about in the paper, that result holds. There is just no difference in the likelihood that a low-performing student exits their school if it's a charter than if it is a traditional public school. So this result's consistent with the only other paper that's looked at another large system. Looked at this question. There's a paper by Zimmer and Guarino that studied an anonymous large school district in the Midwest and found very similar results, that low-performing students are just more highly mobile, but they're not any more mobile out of the charter sector than they are out of the traditional public schools. So a consistent story is emerging. So claims that charter schools are systematically pushing out low-performing or otherwise difficult to educate students simply are not holding up to scrutiny of the actual enrollment data. There's another figure in your materials that presents some meaningful results from my prior work on ELL and students with disabilities. And in both cases, what I find, those are other cases where it's often claimed charter schools are pushing out those students, is the case that both of those students, both students with disabilities and ELL students, are less likely to exit their school if it's a charter than if it's a traditional public school. Now, I'm not claiming that I've proven that counseling out has never happened, doesn't exist. You hear enough stories. There are probably individual cases where students have been inappropriately counseled out of charters or others. But the question is whether this is systematic. And what we're seeing in the data, it's very difficult, I think, to make the claim that that is systematic, given that these enrollment patterns are at least as worrisome within the traditional public school sector as they are in the charter sector. So if we're going to have a conversation about whether or not we should expand the charter school sector in New York City, then those conversations need to be grounded in the real data, not in just the anecdotes. And that's really the purpose of my research, is to ground these conversations inside of data that we can actually observe, to look at the real numbers. So if the argument against expanding charter schools in New York City is that they are systematically removing low-performing or otherwise difficult to educate students, then that argument is simply just not consistent with the data on their true mobility patterns. But that's not to say that the charter sector is perfect, and that, I think, leads us into our conversation today. So my additional goal in this is to provide the real numbers so that the charter sector itself can have some conversations about how to make the system potentially even better than it is for kids. And we should also have those conversations with the real data in mind and not simply based on anecdotes. I think the charter sector is robust enough that we can have real conversations about things like, you know, we'll talk about backfill, I'm sure, about things like a more universal enrollment system. And if we're going to have those conversations, we should have them with the real data in mind. So can and should charter schools do more to serve their neediest students? I think that probably the answer to that is yes, and I'm very interested in our panel and what other people in the room have to say about that issue. And I want to have those conversations with the real data in mind, which is what I'm trying to do in this paper and in with this broader research agenda. So with that, I will turn it over to Josh so we can, I think, have a hopefully a very productive conversation with this excellent panel that's come together.
All right. James, we will start with you, and I'm going to just ask you, should charters be doing more to serve English language learners, special ed kids, and lower performing students in general? And embedded in that question is a larger one, which is, what is the role of New York City's charter sector vis-a-vis the system as a whole?
So I think you're right. Embedded in that question is, what is the role of the sector? And I think as charters have grown to increase their market share. So in Central Harlem, right, we have something like 40, maybe 50% of the K-8 population. As we move from laboratories of innovation to at least partial replacement or alternative to the district at scale, I think the answer, at least politically and for me morally certainly, is yes, we need to do more, have to do more, and can do more. Let me say this, though. You know, the notion, which I think, you know, and Marcus's studies have been so important in actually adding data to this, the notion that we have a bunch of easy kids is really silly. And I've been in enough charters and talked with enough leaders and seen enough classrooms, there are a lot of very difficult to educate kids sitting in charter schools, as clearly there are in district schools. This is hard work, and leaders have been working very, very hard to try to get it done. But, you know, despite the good news that with the L's we have, we're getting them out of L status more quickly and more often, despite the good news that with special education students, we aren't simply replicating the patterns in the district of over-classifying, especially black males, as emotionally disturbed, and we're trying to put kids in less restrictive settings and having more success at educating kids, because I sound like a broken record, I certainly say this every time, the district is magnificent when it comes to enrolling English language learners and special education students. It is not so great at educating them. So if we want to have this discussion, it's a welcome discussion, and whether it's the UFT bringing this data to the fore, whether it's Marcus and the Manhattan Institute, it doesn't matter. These are legitimate questions and inquiry that the charter sector has to take seriously and face head on. But let's do it with the data that we have. I think in terms of what needs to be done to do it, we're already seeing efforts underway. One network has gone from having two people in its central office handling special education to 13. It is not cheap to do. Luckily, special education actually comes with incentives. Money follows the child. English language learners, there's not much money following the child, and English language learners, I think, have been the poor stepchild to special education, in part because special education has a bunch of middle-class parents who care about it. So there isn't the same framework and there isn't the same funding that follows the child. We need to do more with English language learners. We're running a campaign now showing English language learners that the doors are open. We're making sure that our common application is in 6 languages so that parents can access this. But bottom line, and this is an incredibly complex discussion, you know, we need to do more for these populations from both a political standpoint and, in my view, from a moral one as well.
All right, Seth, even if we are to kind of temporarily table the attrition forcing out conversation, there are two major pieces of the puzzle. One is who is deciding to enter the lottery in the first place, and the other is if we assume that, except that low-performing kids are leaving in greater numbers, both in the charter sector and in the district schools, who replaces those students, or does anyone replace those students after they leave? So that's setting you up.
It is setting me up as a softball. Thank you. Thank you, Manhattan Institute and Marcus, for your incredible work on the issue of charters and enrollment patterns over the years. I should also say to Charles that you recycled a bio of mine, so I should explicitly say I'm not speaking on behalf of Democracy Prep today. Katie is doing a great job and needs to speak on behalf of Democracy Prep. I run Democracy Builders, which is a family advocacy organization. And so my provocative remarks especially, and the ones that are most aggressive, are with my Democracy Builders hat on or my Alumni Revolution hat on, not my Democracy Prep hat on. So I just need to give her that insulation before I throw some bombs.
But you literally have your Democracy... Oh, okay. I thought you said you literally had a Democracy Prep hat on.
So this is my Alumni Revolution hat. Okay. Now, for those in the back, it is a slightly confusing color. I get that. But the reason that it's an Alumni Revolution hat is because we now have our first cohorts of students in college, and we're supporting them through college, because if they get to college but don't succeed, it's actually worse for them than if they had got to college and drop out, where they then have debt and no success. So that's our next mission, the next mission of this work. But what I want to start with is a quick anecdote from this morning. I had the unbelievable good fortune of taking 120 students to see Hamilton at the Public Theater yesterday, and it was life-changing. And if you haven't seen it yet, see it. If you can buy tickets on Broadway, if you can afford them, buy them. It is transformative work of art. And this morning, one of the students came in and said to Ms. Trivers, the principal, "Ms. Trivers, you don't even understand. Words can't express how amazing it was. It was as if they were talking about my life on stage." And one of the refrains from the show is, "I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry." And another is that immigrants, they get the job done. And I was thinking about sitting there watching my students react and realizing that Alexander Hamilton would not have been able to go to a charter school. When he arrived in America at 17, he would not have been able to get into a charter school, because charter schools don't open their doors to juniors in high school. They close their doors after, in most cases, fifth grade, and say that no one can come in. Not immigrants, not ELL, not SPED, not anyone. And that is unconscionable in the work that I've spent 10 years of my life doing, and we in this room have to change that, and we have to start today. And we cannot leave this room without committing to starting this work today of letting those students get in those doors after fifth grade or kindergarten, which right now in the sector are pretty much the only chances you'll have to get to a high-performing charter school. And so we have work to do today. We have a lot of work to do today. Because the question to the title is easy. Are charter schools doing all they can to serve the neediest students? Resounding no. And anybody who walks out here thinking yes, and now James and I are in agree, and actually I love what James said, everything I agree with, that's not a question. The question is, are we doing all we can do to serve the neediest students? The answer is unbelievably no, and we can fix it today, we can fix it quickly, and we have a plan to do so. So the question for us is a couple of big challenges. The first is, we now have a chancellor who has said that she doesn't want data to judge schools, right? That's depressing, that's unfortunate, that is unconscionable in my opinion as well, but it's worse to use bad data to judge schools. So it's bad to use no data, it's worse to use bad data. You with me? Okay. Now, we can fix this, because the charter sector can do outreach, can keep its autonomy, can increase transparency, and can increase accountability if we do these things. So, in the room today, I looked at the guest list. If you're a charter operator, staff member, or advocate in some way, you work for a charter advocacy organization, can you raise your hand for me if you're an operator, staff member, or advocate? Okay, we've got 10 or so. So this year's lottery, if you run a charter network, work in one, you can open your doors to all grades and start with K-8. I think you should go through high school for Alexander Hamilton, but you can go today through grade 8, okay? You can today, in your lottery, on April 10th or April 15th or whenever you hold your lottery, open your doors to every single grade that you have a seat to fit in your building. And there's some space issues and there's some issues that we can talk about, but if you have a cohort of 22 and you used to run a cohort of 26, open 4 seats in that grade. Find a way to do it, and find a way to do it today, because this train is coming and you want to get on board. Number two, who are in the room are philanthropists or Manhattan Institute supporters in some way? Who would consider themselves something part of a philanthropy or Manhattan Institute supporter? Great, thank you. So the sector would not exist without philanthropy. And although Democracy Prep, when I was leading it, didn't take philanthropy, the sector would not exist without it. And so first, thank you. Second, you should know that the single biggest correlation we found in our data analysis, which we'll be releasing probably next week, with the net mobility in charter schools, meaning what Marcus is showing in these graphs, all the kids that are leaving charter schools are attrition. And he has found resoundingly, and it's student level data, that that's not any worse. We're not pushing kids, low performing kids out, but we're equally as bad at losing mobile kids, high needs kids, ELL kids, special ed kids, immigrant kids. That's who we're losing. That's reasonable. They're very often homeless. They're very often in the ACS system. They move from family to family, from aunt to uncle. We get that. But then we have a moral obligation to refill the seats of the kids we lose with new kids who are coming in. And right now, we're not doing that. And so the single highest correlation we have found in our research at Democracy Builders between net mobility, meaning the kids you lose and don't replace, not attrition, but net mobility, is philanthropy. Meaning that the philanthropists in the room are subsidizing the kids who leave by filling in the seat with philanthropy instead of per pupil revenue. So every year, the enrollment table at most charter networks in this room goes down. 100, 90, 80, 70, 60, 50, 30. And those seats that are not being educating children, the seats we are leaving behind, are $15,000 each. And what is philanthropy doing? But filling the hole of those seats with $15,000 of philanthropy so they can keep running their operations as though they had a full school, but in fact, they have 90, 100, 80, 70, 60, 50, 30. And so philanthropy is making the problem worse by subsidizing those who are losing students at the highest rates and not filling them in upper grades. Third category, authorizers and policymakers. Who's an authorizer or a policymaker in the room? All right, I got one or two. All right. Some elected officials, others. We have to create incentives. If we don't want this to be mandated on us, if we don't want to lose our autonomy, if we don't want this to be sent to us by the state assembly or by the city council, we have to do this voluntarily through incentives. We have to say to charter operators, if you're an authorizer, we're not going to accept pyramid enrollment tables anymore. We're only going to accept if you enroll a number of kids across the board. And if you make a contract with the city or make a contract with your authorizer to educate 2,000 kids over 5 years, you better educate 2,000 kids over 5 years. Don't make a contract and then say, oh, we're going to only educate 1,500 because they're mobile and we lost them. So the authorizers and the policymakers have work to do and create the incentives through things like the Charter School Stimulus Fund, the Charter School CSP authorization grants to reward those schools both in authorization, reauthorization, and replication with the schools that are doing the best job of keeping their students and the schools that are doing the best job of replacing those when they have seats available. And last but not least is my friends in the media. Who's in the media here today? I saw Jeff. Okay, I got three. You have a big responsibility to hear today too, because you need to stop reporting on bad data. And when you report on percent proficiency, you're making the problem worse. Because every time, now that we have a city administration that doesn't care about data at all, and no Chancellor's Progress Report to measure growth, all we're left with is the media to hold schools accountable, because there's no public accountability on the data side. So when you write a report or you run a press release that says 94% of so-and-so students are proficient in such-and-such, you're forgetting the net mobility of that school means it's 94% of a much smaller denominator. And just to go over the math, if you started with 100 and you end with 30, or whatever your numerator-denominator problem is, you can get to 94% of 30 a lot easier than get to 94% of 100. But we're losing the kids, as Marcus has demonstrated unquestionably, who need us the most. And so at the end of the day, if those four groups step up, we can fix this now, we can fix this application cycle, this April during our lotteries, and I think we have a moral obligation to do that. And so Democracy Builders works with families. We work with families and listen to what they say. And so Mariana is here, and Princess, and Karina, and other people on the Democracy Builders team who've been working really hard to get this report ready. It's a lot of work, and it's really complex, as Marcus knows, to get this data in a form that people can understand. So we're still working on presenting the data in a way that everybody will understand. But the bottom line is that it shows that the charter sector has a lot of work to do, and it's relatively fixable without law, without forcing anybody to do it. We can do it voluntarily ourselves. If we want to be accountable to the kids we serve the most, the Alexander Hamiltons, the immigrants, the low-income kids, the English language learners, then we have an obligation to do that today. And I hope we don't walk out of this room without committing to ourselves and then to each other that we're going to take a major step forward to do this. So I hope that we do, and I hope that's enough fireworks for one speech.
I remind you, please pick up the gauntlets you have thrown on the way out. Ian, your on-the-ground perspective.
Sure. Good morning, everyone, and thank you also to Manhattan Institute for inviting me to be here. Seth, that was a great intro. So I run a network of single-sex public charter schools that's pre-K through 8. And let me just say, in response to Seth, we already backfill through 8th grade in this lottery. We already have. We accept transfer students, so it's part of our ethos. We're a public school. The key is, it's not that you don't backfill or that you don't accept transfer students. You just have to design for it. So in our case, you know, in our pre-K through 8 model, we do something called grade placement assessment. So if, you know, if a fifth grade family wants to enter our lottery, we certainly welcome them. If they win a seat in the lottery, they are guaranteed a seat. We then do an assessment to say, should they be in the fifth grade, should they be in the fourth grade, or the sixth grade, and we place them in the grade that's most appropriate for their, whatever their skill set may be, but they're guaranteed a seat. Also, we have all sorts of interventions that acclimate transfer students into our school. So the week prior to school, we may have things that focus on culture, academics, but the whole idea is that we're a public school open to everyone, and we just need to design the mechanisms to enable them to come into our school effectively. In terms of serving SPED and L students, I think what James said is right. We won't solve the education problem just by addressing enrollment. There's so many things that have to happen once the kids are actually in school. So what do we do once we effectively, enhance our enrollment mechanisms to attract more special education students or English language learners? In our case, we designed for it. So, for example, at every single grade in our school, we have something called CTT classes or collaborative team teaching classes. So at least one class per grade if we have students with an IEP or an individualized education plan, which means that the student has defined special education needs. We have at least one class of that grade, oftentimes two classes on that grade, where we have both a general education teacher and a special education teacher that are paired to essentially address the customized needs for those kids. We also have in our staff learning specialist coordinators that are special ed certified, faculty members that interact with the Council on Special Education. We have learning specialists that provide sets and other needs for students, again, that have IEP mandated services. Same thing for English language learners. We have staff that we are funding, English language learner specialists, whose whole job is to ensure that those kids don't remain English language learners, because guess what? We need to teach them English so that our ratio of L's goes down over time. You know, our general methodology on this is that you design for these things, and most importantly, you have the same high expectations for kids, quote unquote, who are needy, that you have for all kids within the school. So when we have our L specialists who are working with our students, we don't have a special L curriculum that somehow is diminished standards. It's that we want to ensure that they have the same access to the same high level, same rigorous curriculum that every kid in the school should have. In our elementary schools, we're one of the very few schools in New York City that offers science 5 days a week with dedicated science teachers, meaning these are teachers that teach nothing but science. That's a rarity, but it's not as if we somehow, the needy students don't have access to science. And, a little bragging here, we just learned that for the third year in a row, more than 97% of our girls, our fourth grade scholars in our all-girls school and Girls Prep Lower East Side, passed a New York State science exam, putting them in the top 10% of all schools in New York City. We think that's a result of having the same high expectations that we have for all of the kids in the school, whether they're an English language learner, a student with an IEP, whatever. And by the way, many times when we talk about needy students, that's usually a euphemism for We're lowering expectations in some way. That's generally been my experience. There are students at the higher end of the spectrum, too, that are doing really well that also need to be pushed to the next level. So sometimes when we get so focused on the question of what are we doing for our neediest, we lose sight of the fact that there are actually a lot more kids in our school that also need customized instruction. And then just two last points. Obviously, state tests are important. We believe in them. Our kids have to do well on them. They're gateways to success. But we also believe that we privilege two other forms of human expression, persuasive writing and oral argument. Because in the world we live in, you have to speak well, you have to present well, you have to know your stuff, you have to build arguments. And so for us, next year, we'll be piloting in grades 2, 4, 5, 7, and 8, what we're calling these capstone projects, where at the end of the year, every single student in those grades will have to get up in front of a room, sometimes in a room like this, to effectively present through oral argument and then written through persuasive writing, how they have learned what, you know, in terms of science, social studies, arts, math. This is done all over the country in great independent schools. And again, we're not excluding kids who are English language learners or kids with IEPs. We're not excluding kids from that very rigorous high expectation for what they need to be able to demonstrate at the end of the year. You design for these things, you don't not do them. And then finally, we have made an investment in pre-K because part of the whole issue is why are kids, when they are coming to sixth grade, so far behind? And so for us, we have made a determination that we have to start earlier. So we did partner with Sesame Street, phenomenal partnership. So we had our first pre-K launch this year, and we just learned from DOE that we've just been approved for a second pre-K that will open in the Bronx. And so for us, all of this comes down to not only the enrollment, which again, it's important that we backfill and have mechanisms to acclimate transfer students, but most importantly, once they're in the school, what do we do with them? You ensure they have high expectations, that we actually set up interventions that are designed for them to meet the high expectations we have for all of the kids.
Thank you, Ian. I want to get to the lottery a little bit later and how we might improve that process, but I want to ask Marcus and James, to the extent that James might know this, how predominant is attrition without any backfill? I think it's pretty common, if not dominant, throughout New York City. And what is the statistical effect of that over time? Can you give us some sense of how much it matters to the achievement numbers that we so frequently see?
Yeah, I mean, James and Seth might be in a better position to say how often backfill happens. I mean, it'd be hard to get specific numbers, and I'm not sure how you would calculate on what a specific number on what the effect of that is on aggregate test scores. But I think Seth is exactly right. It does have an effect on aggregate test scores. So when U of T and others say, well, one of the reasons why charter schools have higher test scores is because they're losing students and they don't replace them, that's true. That's just math. The problem is when you jump from that to say, therefore, we don't know the charter schools are effective. And that's just simply not true. And the reason for that is we shouldn't be judging any school based on a single aggregate test score number, because the type of student that attends charter schools, that attends different public schools, are very different from one another. That number itself is not very informative about the school's quality. GAIN scores are a little more informative, but still don't get us the entire way we want to go. In the New York City sector, we happen to have a lot of high-quality research that accounts for these things. So we have randomized field trial studies that show us that, on average, the charter schools are very effective. That's how we know the charter schools are working. It's not because their aggregate test scores are on average higher. So I've never actually been one who wanted to use those scores to say that that's why the charter school's sector is effective. I mean, I think I agree. The sector shouldn't be saying that, but we should be pointing to other evidence that shows really conclusively that the sector in New York City has been highly effective, which is not true about charter schools in some other places.
Any response by anybody to that?
I mean, I'll just echo, right? So the best study that we have on charter school effectiveness does take into account student demographics. And that data over time has shown that charter schools are effective. I think it's going to be very hard to pull the discussion to that kind of data than aggregate proficiency in the public arena. I've said for many years now that real estate brokers are the ones who determine what data we use around schools. Because, right, they'll always tell you, well, this school has X percent proficient. That's what people understand. I'm not saying it's right. It's just going to be very hard to pull it away from that.
So it's not, though, because we just spent the last 8 years talking about ABCDF. We did this, we succeeded in this, and then this chancellor broke it. It's something that was working really well for families. If you're a low literacy immigrant family and you walk into a school, you want to know, is it an A, B, C, D, or F? Got it. It happens that that calculation was thoughtful, rigorous, scientific data. 60% was student growth, 15% was parent satisfaction and attendance, only 25%, which to me was still too high, was aggregate proficiency. But you know, we're in a room of friends, and even though there's journalists here, I just wanted to be pretty explicit here and say, like, this, we've got to just do this, guys, because Ian, you're not right, right? You just said that you backfill at every grade. It's not true.
It's true.
Well, you may take some kids at every grade, but the data shows that it's not true. You said that 97% of your kids in science are passing the state exam, but you tested 64 kids in third grade, you tested 44 kids in fourth grade, and then you tout the fourth grade numbers. You lost 20% of the kids in 2014 on your ELA tested assessments.
I was talking about our science exams, by the way.
Of course, but the point is that your third grade numbers were 60 and your fourth grade numbers were 40, give or take. And then you report on the fourth grade numbers in percent proficiency because it's the standard stump speech. But it's not a true speech because your denominator went down by 20.
You're not correct.
Okay, so I'm going to now challenge the audience to say, when we release this data set, to look at the public prep data, look at the girls prep data, and what I'm telling you is that it's your denominator goes down.
And I mean, we don't all have the data to sort through.
No, that's fair. That's fair. But here's what. So the bigger point I'm trying to make, and I'm not trying to pick on Ian per se, because I could pick on everybody in this room on the same level at a charter network. It is simply that when we talk about things as percent proficiency, we are misleading parents, especially low literacy parents. PS6 has a high percentage of proficiency, right? It's an Upper East Side rich school that Carmen Farina used to run. That doesn't make it a good school. The students coming in there are very different than those at PS 154 or at any of the schools in the charter sector. And so if we're reporting on percent proficiency and ranking schools by what percent proficiency those kids are, instead of controlling, which we have the scientific ability to do, we have the statistical ability to do this, for the demographic factors that kids come in with coming in, if we control for things like whether those students have disabilities, ELL status, whether they are losing students over time, we can actually come up with a much more precise indicator, as the Chancellor's Progress Report used to do, of whether a school is actually serving the students that they have well. And here's what I want to agree with Marcus on wholeheartedly. The data here is unquestionable. So I am as strong a charter supporter as there is, right? I have spent the last 10 years of my life building charter schools. We have 15 charter schools that I've built, and they are incredibly good for the students we serve. They are not perfect. They have a lot of work to do. We should do better on backfill. We should do better on ELL. We should do better on SPED. There is tons of work to do here, and I'm going to certainly take the same message to heart. But the random control trial that Democracy Prep did, which looked at the kids at the lottery stage and said we had 7,000 apply, we had 700 enter, how did those two kids do over the next 4 years? Roland Fryer at Harvard said it had the highest impacts they've ever seen. And so that kind of random control trial is the gold standard of research. I mean, if we just sort of looked at medical research in percent proficiency, we would have people dying because of the research, right? That's a terrible way to just decide whether the pill worked or not. You actually have to have a double-blind control. And there is great research that's been done at Stanford, Harvard, MIT, to show that the New York charter sector works. So if we're working better, which most of us in this room can presuppose, then open the doors to all kids, especially the kids who need us most, and stop keeping kids out who need us the most.
Okay, Ian, I'll give you a minute.
Sure. I mean, if your point is that we need better mechanisms for families to choose good schools, wholeheartedly agree. If you're making the point that we should not report on percent proficiency but really focus on growth, I do think the mechanism that was used in the progress report ABCDF is good, but it certainly wasn't imperfect. There were lots of schools that received A's and B's that were not good schools. I mean, Democracy Prep is a great example of when you use growth as a measure. If you've got a lot of kids in your school that have had a very low starting point, you can show astronomical growth and make it seem, I think you use this phrase, an illusion of success. You can have an illusion of success if you start with a group of very low performing students and only show progress. So it has to be some combination. I'm not quite sure where you're going with it, but there's no single data point that any parent should use to choose a school. So, for example, if I say that 97% of our fourth grade scholars, that's a singular data point. That doesn't, unto itself, make us a great school. That's why we do so much outreach to our families to talk about our culture and where our kids are going to high school and the college partnerships that we have. There's so many factors that drive what makes a great school, so I think it's not wise to say that even if we go back to the, you know, we had 26% proficiency across all of New York City schools with the progress report system that you seem to be advocating for. So I just think we sometimes get so mired in these debates of what are the numerical outcomes that matter most. And there are a lot of different factors. And let's talk about, again, I think some of the things I think are important to what we're doing once we have kids in our school. How do we learn from those best practices?
Okay. Whether or not you think backfill or lack of backfill is working well, a lot of it comes back to the lottery. If schools backfill students, they still backfill out of the pool that's applied to the lottery, correct?
Correct.
So question for you, James, and anyone else who wants to jump in. How can the lottery be improved? Obviously, by the very nature of it, it means that somewhat motivated families are the ones who get into it. That's not necessarily a bad thing at all. Is it working the way it should?
I mean, it's working the way it was designed. And this means that, you know, what we have now are schools of choice. And we have said that partly what we do is we provide more parent choice to choose into a school. And there's something very compelling about the notion of having schools that parents choose into. And let's be clear that this is a phenomenon. This is how the public school system is designed, at least for the middle class.
Can you just back up for a second, just explain to people how the lottery currently works for a family and other models that it, other ways in
sure.
which it could work?
Sure. So the way the lottery works is basically you just have to fill out a very simple application, but you have to affirmatively choose into the lottery pool by filling out that application. Then basically there are some preferences for siblings and for students within the community school district who reside there. You can add in preferences for disadvantaged students, English language learners, special education status, free and reduced price lunch eligible. And basically then you pull numbers and whoever gets in, gets in. If they accept, they're in. If they don't, you go down the list until you exhaust either the list or the number of seats that you have, and then you usually maintain a waiting list. And then through the year, if you want to come into the school as a mid-year transfer, you'd go to the bottom of the waiting list. So that's how it's designed to work. There are alternatives to this, and I'll talk about it, but I just want to go back to the notion of choice. Is it working the way it should? So, right, charters are viewed as singular in the sense of giving parents choice, and that is just not true. Our school system is designed to give middle-class parents choice and to exclude poor kids, right? We do it through zoned lines for attendance, which is done by housing. And housing patterns are highly segregated in this city. In fact, that's why we have one of the most segregated systems in the world. And then, number two, we do it through screened schools. So for the middle class, they've always had public school choice. I moved out to New Jersey and chose into a school district that I thought would work for my child well. And that school district and its boundaries, which is very close to Newark, works better than barbed wire at keeping poor kids out of my district. So we have school choice for middle class kids. What charters have done is provide school choice for kids who are poor. So it is not as controversial or different. So then why I'm getting at this is because while I agree with Seth in very many respects, it's a question of what you want the charter sector to do. So if you want to have a school that has a high discipline and rigorous academics, you are going to attrit out kids. That is just a given, right? Now, Stuyvesant never lets them in, right? So, but, you know, and MS 51, where the mayor sent one of his kids, never lets those kids in, right? They're only threes and fours on the state test, get into that school, plus a whole bunch of subjective measures, which I can't begin to understand. So it depends on what you want out of the charter system. Do you want it to be choice schools, or do you want it to mirror the schools in the neighborhood in terms of enrollment? I'll say one other thing and get to the thing, right? Get to your point about the lottery. The lottery isn't really endemic to the notion of chartering, random enrollment. Chartering is about choice for parents, autonomy, and accountability. Those are the three pillars. The lottery is appended to it politically because people didn't want charters to cream students, to take only the good kids. That's why we have a lottery. So in a world where we didn't have politics, we could imagine charters that were gifted and talented, right? That have autonomy and accountability. They'd be GNT schools. They'd be schools that are zoned enrollment. So literally every kid within the zone would have the option to attend that school. And in fact, this is a trend we are starting to see. So in Denver, in Washington, in Philadelphia, in Newark, people are moving to common enrollment systems with the district, where just as in New York with the high school choice system we have in our public schools, basically you list your preferences and then you get your one best choice, and it's through a formula created by a Nobel Prize winning economist who created the match system for medical residency. And so Al Roth has done this system in his group with a number of cities. Is this something that is possible in New York? It is something that's possible. I think in the present political conversation, it's difficult. One of the things in cities where this has worked and created greater diversity and I think lowered the political temperature around charters, made them less controversial, is I think it requires trust in the school chancellor slash city hall. And right now, unfortunately, I don't think there is that trust between the charter sector and city hall.
Can I just, I think you're right, and also the moving towards, so my previous work on ELLs and the special and students with special needs shows pretty strongly that you can't address those gaps by focusing on who's exiting the schools. Certainly not ELL, a little bit with special needs students, it's a story about classifications as well. But the biggest driver is who's applying in the first place, and particularly for ELL students. I mean, the entirety of the gap between the percentage of kids in charter and public schools, the difference in ELL, that's all coming from ELL kids are just much less likely to apply to attend charter schools. And one way to address that is through a more common system. And in fact, if backfill alone won't address this either, because the pool itself, you're still drawing from that larger pool. So I think that definitely needs to be part of the conversation.
Okay, audience questions. Raise your hand if you want to. David Bloomfield.
Good morning. Thank you. David Bloomfield, Brooklyn College and the CUNY Grad Center. I want to ask about the related question of disciplinary policies. And this goes to what James was just talking about, first principles of flexibility and accountability. Would you favor a common voluntary disciplinary code, transparency of disciplinary code, or possibly a legally mandated disciplinary code for charter schools?
I mean, a legally mandated disciplinary code would seem to impinge upon charter school autonomy off the bat, but what do you think, James?
Well, so ideally, right, you'd be able to separate out, autonomy wouldn't pertain to who you educate, it'd pertain to how you educate, but as you and I think everyone in the room knows, when it comes to discipline, who you educate depends, you know, also impinges on how you educate. So in a high discipline system, you're going to trade out. To answer your question, I'd like to start and am a strong supporter in transparency.
Yeah,
I do not know why we don't have complete and utter transparency around that for
100%.
Both district and charter schools. It's just crazy that we don't have good backfill data, which we don't, because while we can follow classes, we don't know who's retained. We should know exactly in every school across this system who's leaving, what are the characteristics of leaving, who's being placed at what grades and so forth. I mean, it's just crazy we don't have transparency.
How do we get, are you saying transparency through government mandates or transparency by the charter sector coming forward independently?
I mean, this is not just a charter sector issue. This is a every school issue. I'd love to see the Board of Regents really, they've got the data. City Hall obviously has the data. I don't understand why people aren't just publishing these reports as a matter of course.
I agree.
Okay, more questions?
Let me just say there is actually a transparency bill in the City Council right now. Democracy Builders has been working with Mark Levine, a City Councilman from Harlem, who has introduced a bill to specifically look at this question, and we're going to be seeing an amendment to include both district schools and charter schools in their transparency, which is step one to David's question.
Yeah.
John Stossel in the back.
All this attrition and not that much backfill, where do the kids go? Are they not in school?
Perfect question. It is.
They go to district schools.
They go to the worst district schools in New York City because they can't get into the good charter schools because the good charter schools are closing their doors. So you take the kids who leave, as Marcus shows, who are the most vulnerable, the most in need of a high-quality education, and then you end up with them in the worst-quality schools that have no waiting list in the New York City portfolio. So it is the worst-case scenario for those kids of all.
Robert George Furrow Brow. you have something you really want to say.
Yeah, thank you. I guess this is to Seth. First of all, I agree it's disgraceful that City DOE decides that they're not interested in data. That's kind of horrific. But my history is that the Bloomberg view of the ABCD calculation was actually pretty confusing, I think, and that seemed to be the case. I'm not gonna speak for my colleague Mr. Greenman up here, but I think both, you know, the Post, the Times, and I think the Daily News as well all kind of had stories about the fact that parents just didn't really know why a seemingly high performing school in terms of test scores was considered like a B or a C school and so forth. So I think the data issue is a little bit more complicated. Yep. in terms of trying to figure things out.
Well, and it was because of how the progress report was constructed. As Seth said, 60% of the grade was progress. So again, if you were really a school with very low performing students, you got some incremental growth. It might seem that you were just this astronomical school, and you might get a B or an A, where a school that maybe already had, mostly test scores are the foundation for all of this. But if you're a school with high test scores, and you still got incremental growth, but it was much lower, you might be viewed as still an A or a B school, but how do you discern the difference between those two types of schools?
Yeah, and the other thing is that progress scores, the more sophisticated they get, the more complicated they get.
Right.
So if you have a really, really sophisticated progress algorithm to determine value-added growth, it's really hard for a parent to understand, to look at that algorithm and understand what it is saying.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's advocating that for a low literacy parent or an ELL parent, we're going to expect them to understand the algorithm behind the ABC system. What I'm arguing very simply is exactly what Ian says, which is we should incentivize schools to take the lowest performing kids. And good schools especially should be incentivized to take the lowest performing kids, the kids that are toughest to educate. And the old system did that, and the new system doesn't do that. It actually disincentivizes you from taking the toughest kids, because now you're only judged on what the headline in any of those papers is, which is what percent proficient are they. But that says now let's reduce our denominator every year, because that is going to increase our numerator. And when we look at the charter sector, the sad reality, and I think that, if there's any takeaway from this, I think we should be honest with ourselves in the charter sector that are supporting expansion and growth of our sector, because we're doing a better job. And being honest with ourselves, we need to recognize that the number of proficient children in charter schools across the city doesn't increase over time. the number of proficient children in charter schools in New York City goes down over time. And that's because we are attriting students and not replacing them. And so what we need to do is make it clearer for parents which schools are right for their kid. And so the point that I think the Chancellor's Progress Report in the old system did better than any other was to say, if your child is a struggling student, you want to find an A-rated school because that school is doing better with struggling students than maybe Bronx Sciences, which might be a B, but is only taking the top 1% of kids in the city of New York.
I mean, the number does go up over time and grows in that the sector is growing. Right, but you're saying by school.
You're correct. The average number, as the sector grows, the number of kids does. That's a fair point. But the average number of kids per school who are proficient or advanced on the New York State exams is actually going down in charter schools across New York City. Now, that doesn't mean, to whatever the chancellor and her allies will say, the charter schools are failing or pushing kids out. The research shows very much otherwise. But it shows we have a moral obligation to step up and do even more.
So isn't the backfilling problem really a problem of scarcity of great schools in the district sector versus a problem of scale and capacity in the charter school sector? I mean, Seth, who I deeply respect you know this. I think I've been violent. Well, you may not have known it until now. I think I'm in violent disagreement with you about this because, you know, not every school is right for every kid. And it sounds like you're trying to use backfilling to solve for the fact that the districts haven't gotten their act together.
So it's a great point, and I love you deeply and the work you do, but I violently disagree with you, and here's why. Charter schools are operating like it's 2006. Guys, it's not 2006 anymore. In 2006, in Harlem, there were like 3 charter schools. And so any kid that left us went into this you know, array of mediocre district schools. Today in Central Harlem, it's 50% of the K-8 kids are in charter schools, which means every time a kid leaves at one of the charter schools, which are dramatically better than the district schools, undeniably, they go into a worse school. So now we're taking the kids who need us the most, low-income, immigrant, ELL, SPED, and putting them in the worst schools. So are you right about the scarcity of district-quality schools? Of course. So let's eliminate, close, shutter the bad district schools and replace them with good new charter schools. But we, without increasing the charter cap, without doing a single thing legislatively or policy, we could add thousands of new seats in the charter sector today in this April's lottery, voluntarily by the people in this room and in this sector. And so we have in our capacity, with no law, no mandate, no loss of autonomy, thousands of seats we are not giving to the kids who need them most, and that is not okay.
Yes, at this table.
Hi, thank you. My name is Peter Goodman. I write a blog called Ed and the Apple. The U of T recently put out some data that said that the suspension rates in charter schools were significantly higher than in public schools. And we know there's a lot of discussion about the school-to-prison pipeline, that kids who are suspended have a much greater chance of dropping out and ending up in prison and everything else. How do you respond to the accusation that charter schools suspend greater number of kids? And first of all, is it accurate? And
James, you want to take that?
Well, I think actually I'd like to hear from Ian on this. But, I mean, I haven't looked at their data closely. I don't dispute that the suspension rates are likely to be higher at charters than at district schools. I'm not sure that's, you know, high suspension rates. We want to try to drive them down. Having them, that data be public will, I think, drive them down. On the other hand, we don't want disorderly schools either. And I think there's a lot of cant. So the city council has been pushing on the district to reduce suspensions. They'll probably manage to drive the numbers down. Will we have an increase in good outcomes for the kids who would otherwise be suspended? I'm not so sure the one follows from the other. I think trying to figure out how to get an orderly school and not suspend is a really, really difficult thing. And as I've said before, I got to tell you, I think if the UFT teachers and charter teachers got together, the one thing they'd agree on most is they want an orderly classroom and they want administrative help to maintain an orderly classroom.
Ian?
Sure. So I can't speak for the sector. I think Jeff Decker is here somewhere. I think he just did a story in Chalkbeat on suspensions in the charter sector, and I think there's this chart, and public prep our schools, you know, is the one of the lowest, or if not the lowest in the entire city in terms of suspension. Like, you know, again, for us, so much of what we do, again, is design. Like, the reason I think suspensions happen is typically kids are bored, they're not engaged, there isn't effective teaching going on. So we try to develop strategies where we have highly rigorous curriculum, kids are engaged, so we don't have to resort to suspension, high rates of suspensions as the way to create an orderly environment. And so, again, I'm happy that we're having a discussion about enrollment and backfilling, and let's be transparent on those things, at least just to get that issue out of the way, so we can focus on actually what happens in school to create the learning environment that's going to get all of our kids to move forward.
Okay, one more question. Yes, ma'am.
Good morning. Melissa Silverman from College Spring. My question is about just, there's been an incredible amount of innovation and design in all of the features that make all of the schools we've been talking about successful. And I guess I would ask the panel to imagine some potential future innovations for the next generation of charter work that actually serve the population that Marcus has been sharing some data with us about. Like, what if you, since we know you can do anything and your results are amazing, what might you do to take us to the next level?
So for this, we're going to table the backfill part of the conversation, talk about other things that might be that might improve outcomes for special ed students, ELLs, and otherwise low-performing kids.
Yeah, I mean, I think for networks are going to have an easier time adjusting and growing and expanding the spectrum of students they serve. They are mini districts, some not so many anymore, that will be able to pool resources from their various schools so that they can, for instance, start a 12 one-to-one classroom, you know, one classroom of 12 kids, very severe needs children. I think where we're going to have to build structures is among the independent charters. I think it is unrealistic to expect a small 300 child school to serve every kind of child. That's not what the districts do. And in fact, upstate, where we have these small rural schools, what do? They pool those kids into what are called BOCES, Boards of Cooperative Educational Services. So I think one of the innovations that is going to have to come up is how we pool services for schools so that we can serve a broader variety of children. And I think these are things that the district itself should be thinking about. And there's this constant push and pull of specialization, putting all the kids in one building with highly specialized faculty that can deal with them, and then the desire of mainstreaming and having those kids be at their neighborhood school. I'm not sure where we're going to end up right now in the charter sector. We're much more at the individual school building. I think we're going to have to do some pooling.
Okay, we'll each take just a couple of minutes, and then we'll close.
So I love the question because I think it is really what we need to think about. I think the sector is dramatically better than district schools, which doesn't mean we're amazing. We have a ton of work to do. In fact, the data shows that we're not improving anywhere near the speed we need to, given the challenge of the problem. So I'm bullish on technology. I've spent the last year and a half working in the public sector on education technology and think that the opportunity of blended learning to really tailor and personalize instruction for every kid. We used to talk about differentiation in small groups and sort of what do we do in terms of how do we regroup and reclassify kids, but our student-teacher ratios stayed about the same, and technology allows us to change and rethink that completely. So I'm working on a new model of schools that will be advancing blended learning and start at the high school level. I know that Achievement First has taken a real step in this direction in their Greenfield Schools project, which is something that I'm excited to see how that comes out. I think there's incredible possibility and opportunity in the charter sector because of the autonomy we have. I don't want to see that autonomy erode, but the thing that will erode autonomy the most is if we're not honest about where we are and what we actually can do and take ourselves to task when we're not doing a good enough job.
Yeah,
the way that we think about sort of future innovations is all about this idea of authentic assessments that really demand real world knowledge and learning. And so, you know, if we look into the future, you know, we want to graduate amazing kids from 4-year universities who are productive, effective, good citizens. What does that look like if you reverse integrate to what does that kid need to be able to demonstrate at 12th grade, 11th grade, 10th grade, and have at each grade a certain level of expectations that they have to demonstrate in some authentic way? It's one of the reasons we're moving to these capstone projects. So beyond the state tests, which are, you know, paper and pencil tests, at the end of each year, this idea that you have to do an oral presentation, persuasive writing around science, social studies, the arts, pick some huge issue in the world. You know, why is it that young people get acclimated to the world of ISIS and decide that they can terrorize? Like, how does that happen? How would you solve that problem? How would you solve the water crisis in the Sudan, which has led to these issues? You create authentic assessments at each grade, which require and demand kids to perform, to demonstrate what they've learned in very real ways. I think that, for us, we think could be transformative, would change this entire conversation that we just had in this room, if we focused on authentic assessments that demand real world learning.
All right. Thank you, Ian. Thank you, Seth, James, Marcus. It was a very provocative and constructive conversation, and thanks to the Manhattan Institute.